The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Welcome to We the People Radio. You're joining Aaron, Bill, and Bob. And our guest, Lauren Spivak, for the second hour. If you missed the first hour, you should definitely go back and listen. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. We appreciate your retweets of our program so that people find us. That seems to be the quickest way to find us. You can join us on Facebook, too. It just kind of sits there, but, you know, I guess everybody says go like us on Facebook. So whatever, for whatever that's worth, yeah, go do that. definitely forward out this program because there's a ton of good information, and the best part about it is Lauren will travel to your town when it fits into his schedule, and he's always traveling. How many weeks of the year do you travel, Lauren? All of them?
Oh, my gosh. Not all of them.
51?
But I travel a lot, and obviously I'm trying to do pretty much the entire continental United States, so I kind of have to, you know, develop a pattern, but I'll be in, I'm in the Virginia area for most of the next 6 weeks. I'm going to be in Ohio in July, and by early August and September back in California again.
Right on. I know some guys.
California, you have no idea how big your state is until you've tried to speak to it all. I keep going back to California, and I leave feeling like I barely scratched the surface.
Oh, it's true. Well, that's why we only get knuckleheads for governors, because you have to be a, you know, gazillionaire or have huge name recognition to hit this whole state. It's I'm not going to say it's impossible, because we still hold out hope we can get somebody besides a knucklehead, but it is very, very difficult thanks to the geography, which would be why there's a really really strong movement, actually, to split the state. And I wouldn't say in half, but to create a 51st state would help us a lot, actually. We have very different politics, very different economic needs, very different geography and resources. And, yeah. And then you could come and speak to yet another state. See, that would be easier.
You can be my 26th state.
We can't actually shrink the geography. There would still be the same landmass, but it would
without going anywhere new.
It would be called a new state. Then it would feel better, you know. It's a little bit like in the East Coast, you know, you blow up through, you know, Connecticut, Massachusetts, you know.
And a lot of people do believe that, you know, 57 states is enough.
yeah, what is it? Oh, my gosh.
Well, I think, you know, and as a New Englander, you know, I've always felt that, you know, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island really could pretty much combine together into one state because they're so small and there isn't really a dime's worth of difference between them.
That's really true. When we,
you know, the difference between San Diego and Redding is about as great a difference as, you know, two cities could possibly have.
Yeah, Texas and Alaska.
Yeah, wildly different. Well, so all geography lessons aside, I do know some folks in Virginia, so I'll get a hold of them next week and see if you're already speaking to them or not. And they're right there. Shoot, got 6 weeks. Yeah, we've got resources over there. And now the last hour of the show it'll air in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore this coming Tuesday. So they'll have your information, which is great. And make sure we leave that all up online all week so people can go there and check it out. So let's see. You have three seminars. Do we call them all economic literacy?
Well, no, economic literacy is my first seminar.
Oh, that's what it's called. Okay.
Yes, it's called economic literacy. The second one, Getting There From Here, is really a political seminar. It's about political strategy. But you know, strategy, you know, I don't find other people talking about. I'll tell you, if I have a thought and I look around and everyone else is already talking about it, you know, then I really don't need to bother. But what I try to do is talk about a lot of ideas that I'm really not hearing about practically how to shrink the government, how to get, you know, my ideal is to get an administration in there, not simply that has an R after their name, but that is committed to making government smaller than it is now. And even the word smaller has become corrupted. You know, when Republicans, sadly, when most Republicans say smaller, what they mean is that, you know, smaller than the Democrats, you know, would like to make us. Which, you know, means smaller than infinity. It means essentially nothing. I think smaller should mean of a lesser size than it is today.
Yeah, not a slower amount of growth. You know, let's back it up a little bit and shrink it.
But that's right. But that's right. Reduction. And what we do know from historical experience is the few times that this has actually been tried, and the three that stand out for me are, you know, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in Britain, and the Harding Coolidge administration in the United States at the end of the First World War. And in all three cases, it led to an instant economic boom. A lot of people forget that we had a big recession in 1920, but then Harding and Coolidge shrunk the federal government. We suddenly, you know, within months, are in an economic boom that not only ensures, you know, Coolidge's reelection, but it ensures, you know, your Republican dynasty. And Margaret Thatcher achieved the same thing in Britain in the 80s. And so what I've been telling groups of late is that if we elect a Republican president next year, and for whatever reason he decides to do nothing, the economy will continue to stink, it will continue to go nowhere, and within a few months it'll be the Republicans' fault. And the Democrats will say, I would be surprised if any one of your listeners doubt me on this, within a few months the Democrats will be saying that it's all the Republicans' fault. And then what we need is lots more socialism. Clearly, you don't have enough socialism because the economy is so bad, and that's what the solution is. And then the Republican will be forced to run for re-election, you know, defending the status quo. And this is just, to me, this is just a nightmare. Whereas, alternatively, if we have a Republican administration, and I'm pretty sure we'll have a Republican Congress too, that's committed to left government, then you will have the kind of boom we saw in the United States under Reagan, in Britain under Thatcher, and the United States, you know, with Harding and Coolidge, where the economy really grows and you can turn a whole generation into Republicans. I mean, this is the great hinge of faith here is not so much on Election Day as on what gets done after Election Day. And I would be absolutely, you know, reduced to tears if the Republicans win this in 2016 and elect to squander it all by doing nothing.
That would be...
Yeah, and you know, unfortunately, with the whole presidential deal, if you polled, you know, 10 people between the age of 18 and 25 and asked them who the last three presidents were, they probably couldn't tell you. And that's the voting base we're looking at right now. They're just woefully uninformed, and they don't really understand who the players are in this mega system we have now. And I don't know. I guess I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if we do have a Republican president and a Republican House and Senate, do you really think they're going to take their one shot and make change? Because I think your cowardly lion depiction is
pretty true. We have a very different group of Republicans now than you've had in the past. In 2010, we loaded in a different, you know.
Yeah, you still have the power base in there.
Well, and you also have people watching.
I was going to say, I think it's possible. I think it's about who it is. And I'll tell you something else. I mean, I bemoan the fact that young people are ignorant of what's going on in the world as much as anybody does. In fact, this is something which we talk about in my third seminar, The Search for Superhuman Wisdom, you know, where we're looking for wisdom, as the title implies. And one of the things that we talk about is that people are frequently, they say one of the reasons why I think democracy is such a imperfect system is that people tend to vote based on ignorance. People vote based on, you know, weird feelings of, you know, you know, connectedness to something or other, you know, whether it's simply an ethnic identity. I can remember in 1988, when I lived in Brooklyn, and the Greek community in Brooklyn was just ecstatic about Michael Dukakis running for president. He was Greek. And it's like, yeah, how silly is this? You know, who cares? You know, I care about his policies.
Well,
but you know, people tend to vote based on really silly things. And on the other hand, I'll tell you the good news in this. Do you know what people, including ignorant people, including young people, will understand? They will understand the difference between a booming economy and a going nowhere economy. Okay? The most ignorant among us, most of them, there's a few exceptions, but the majority, understand that the economy is going nowhere today. And if you bring in the right kind of Republican president, you know, the next Ronald Reagan, who shrinks the government, because there's nothing that's slowing down the U.S. economy other than the U.S. government. That is the problem. There's nothing else. And he shrinks the government, and the economy booms. They will know the economy is booming. Ronald Reagan turned, and I was there. Heck, I was one of them. Ronald Reagan turned a whole generation of young people into Republicans because they saw it happen.
Right, and it gets back to the same thing.
He made it happen.
You hit
Margaret
him in the checkbook.
Margaret Thatcher turned a whole generation of young Britons into conservatives because she made it work. The lesson, and again, this is very much what the Wizard of Oz is about, the Democrats are always going to be better at communication. They're always going to be better spin doctors than we are. And that's just the way it is, okay? They spin like nobody, like nobody's business. But the one thing that the conservative movement has that they don't is we actually know how to make the economy work. And if we do it, that message will beat any spin. People know when their fortunes are soaring upward, as they did in all those three examples I gave you, and that will turn the electorate around. Because the reason that I will be absolutely, you know, despondent if the Republicans screw this up is because there is such an opportunity here to demonstrate what really can happen and the good that can come of it. And what terrifies me is the thought of throwing that away and having a generation never see what a difference capitalism can make, and then they'll just be left to the spin that the Democrats give.
Well,
that's really the decision that we're making.
Yeah,
and I agree. I agree 100%. And I think one of the hurdles we have to overcome, excuse me, is they had a chance before.
And they
blew it big time.
The public is very, look at the public though. Look at the way people were paying attention back then, which they weren't because they were making money.
Oh, yeah.
They were busy.
There was a lot of money flowing.
Now look at who's watching.
No,
so the
true.
Accountability is very, very different, and that creates a different outcome.
No, you're right.
Of course I'm right. Because now we have to go to a break and everyone can just savor how right I was.
Well, you're going to hear about it. Well, fortunately, the folks out there won't hear what I got to say after
Bill's
break.
Got some pointy back scratcher thing. He's like,
bludgeoning
somebody. Waving around. I'm gonna go fight off the back scratcher. We'll be back with you in 2 minutes. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All right, that's it.
All right, come here.
You're listening to We the People Radio on Community Talk Radio for the North State, AM 1460 KCNR.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces sometimes, they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces tell lies, and I've got proof.
It's all about the music. You're rejoining We the People Radio. Hop online, check out the webpage, wethepeopleradio.us. It has everything about our guest, Lauren Spivak, his three books, seminars, talks. He's like the only guy who's actually smart and funny at the same time that I know of that speaks for free to pretty much any size group, I think. Because, you know, a lot of people speak for free, but there's a reason it's free. And so we just wanted to dispel that myth right now. It's worth money. He just doesn't charge you.
So I'm dying to know. You know, we talked a little bit about the plot on your next book. Does the cowardly lion get courage?
Does he get?
Or the cowardly rhino? Does he end up with courage in the end?
Well, what happens is they when they're with the they meet Hillary in her lair, and she's got remember the flying monkeys.
Oh yeah.
So they're all government union people. Basically, they're a bunch of union goons who beat up the witch's opponents. So they basically kidnap our heroes and bring them into the witch's lair. And what happens, and this is, you know, obviously I'm endeavoring to create some suspense here, but the red box, remember the red box that she's been carrying through the entire story?
Oh, yeah.
Gets dropped, and it bursts open, and what pops out of it is all of the wisdom of the American founding. And even beyond, it's John Locke and Hume and James Madison and Calvin Coolidge and Friedrich Hayek and Abraham Lincoln and Bastiat and like all of the great scholars of freedom throughout history, and all of their wisdom pops out. And let me take a moment here to give a thank you to my illustrator, because this, you know, it's tough to illustrate conceptions like this. And this one I actually think was done really brilliantly, where all of this wisdom comes out of the box about how, you know, a wise and frugal government, which will not take from the mouth of labor the bread it's earned, you know, Jefferson, that all of this stuff pops out and basically destroys the witch. They say what she can't deal with, you know, is all of this truth, and she melts.
So truth melts.
Gone.
Yeah.
And the flying monkeys, who are all labor union goons, you know, realize, you know, that the spell is broken. You know, now they'd rather be free, independent people than simply, you know, enforcers for this political regime. And so the entire gang heads back to the Emerald City to re-meet the wizard. And there's a couple things I did here. One is to have Bill Clinton utterly unconcerned about the fate of Hillary. That was one of the themes I wanted to have. And the second, as I said, is that he is going to actually, not because he's not the good guy at all, but because he doesn't care. You know, he's just neutral. You know, that he's going to tell him the whole truth about all of this. So he explains to the Scarecrow that you don't learn stuff from going to an Ivy League school and listening to a bunch of left-wing blowhards, you know, blather about their crazy theories. You learn stuff by doing. And the Scarecrow is like, you know, so I don't just have to repeat things that I'm told. I can actually make my own unique contribution to the world and learn how to do things and satisfy other people's needs and thus advance myself. And then the Tin Man, and this is, again, you know, the great thing about writing books, what makes writing books addictive, is that there's certain ideas, you know, that I really deeply believe in, and I get to, like, you know, fill my books with them. And the second one is that the Tin Man's lesson is that how you help the poor is to produce stuff, not to pay taxes. Government does not help the poor. And I'm certainly not opposed to charity, but I'll tell you, Henry Ford helped poor people by making cars. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. He created jobs.
He gave to charity, too. That's lovely.
Right.
But he really helped the poor by making cars, because Henry Ford did not invent the car. People think he invented it. He did not. He invented the inexpensive car. Rich people had cars before Henry Ford. Henry Ford had to figure out how to make them cheap enough so that regular people could buy one. And that's what really was the revolution. Sam Walton, you know, who founded Walmart, helped the poor by bringing goods to market more cheaply than other retailers were. So people's, you know, limited money went further. And this is how you help the poor. So that's what the Tin Man's lesson is that capitalism is something you should be ashamed of, and helping the poor is not something you do to make amends for your having been a capitalist. The fact is, the capitalist makes money at the exact same instant that he's improving someone else's life, because that's what capitalism is.
So, if we take that a step further, one of my experiences here in the last week was I saw a whole group of homeless people in a parking lot. It was after 5, you know, the sun was going down, and it was getting late, and they were popping out of the bushes and just congregating in this parking lot. And the thing that amazed me was probably 90% of them had a cell phone. So I guess Apple helped the poor, too.
And I know that businesses are helping, because the fence blew down in our parking lot. And so now the homeless kind of, I don't know, it's a little bit of like a camp, I guess, on the other side of the fence that we didn't know anything about because there was a fence there, didn't see it. Now they're all using our outside power outlets to charge all their electronic devices.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of them. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Welcome
yeah.
to the 21st
century. I need to get out more. Things have
changed. I'm not bashing on the poor. I'm not bashing on the homeless. But
oh, you are.
Without capitalism, without the American people's ability to produce...
sure, to pay the taxes and put the phones.
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes our system work.
That's what you need to do, Lauren. Do a book that's a parody on the house that Jack built. Because you know what I mean? The people that went to work so that they could earn a living, so they could pay the taxes, so that, the people who don't can have all these things.
Sure, but if at the end of the day, you know, who feeds the person who's hungry?
Exactly.
You know, the farmer who grows crops. You know, does the guy in the government printing office who prints off food stamps, is he feeding the poor?
Or the guy regulates the farmer and makes it impossible for him to.
Well, look what happens to charities when we're in a great recession and nobody has any money. What happens then? What happens to these charities that, you know, survive on, you know, the good heart of people that provide them the money to operate? It goes away in a recession.
Sure, but again, I'm taking this a step farther than you are, and I'm not disagreeing with you. I just want people to take this one step farther. The charities are very, very nice. I have nothing against the charity. But it is the capitalist engaged in capitalism helps the poor more than when that same capitalist is engaged in charity.
No, I think we're saying the same thing. No, I totally agree with that.
So it's the production, it's the innovation, it's things like that. Well, you mentioned about the cell phones. When I was a kid, there were, I don't know if we called them cell phones, they were like car phones. But, like, super-duper rich people had a phone in their car. You know, the President of the United States would have a phone in his car. Maybe a multi-millionaire would have a phone in his car. The idea that regular people would have a phone in their car, you know, would have seemed absurd to me when I was a kid in the 1970s. And now, every kid, every 12-year-old in the playground has got his own cell phone. Okay? That huge improvement came from people... from capitalists seeking to make money, not to improve the human condition, but to make money. And as Adam Smith, you know, explained 240 years ago, it's the invisible hand of the market. You help people by when you seek to make money, even though that's not your original, you know, intention. It doesn't matter. And all government really does is get in the way of that process and slow down the growth of the economy, which is what actually helps the poor and raises all the boats.
Exactly. And we will pursue this on the backside of a little break we have to take. We're talking to Lauren Spivak, and you can find everything you need to find about him and his books and seminars and speaking and all that good stuff on wethepeopleradio.us.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
We're monkeys, and people say we're monkeying around. We're too busy singing to put anybody down.
Amen. Hey, Lauren, I got a question for you. You know, we're talking about the producers and free markets. Do you think that we've gone down this road so far with, you know, free this and free that, and so many people now are on government assistance of some sort? Do you think the voting base is going to be willing to give up some of that free stuff for a job, for a new way of life, of making it on your own? I mean, there's just so many people out there that depend on, even depend on mom and dad, and they're 40 years old. I mean, do you think we've kind of crossed a threshold here where we can't come back from that?
Well, it is a great and very, very relevant question, and my answer is no, I don't think so. I really don't believe that there are irreversible lines you can cross and you can't go back. Karl Marx, who comes up in The Wizard of Oz, comes up at the end. Karl Marx, you know, believed in this deterministic concept of history, that history moves from this point to this point and this point, and that's the way it's got to go, and there's no going back. And I do reject that. Now, that's not to say that everything is for sure going to be fine. I think that history is dependent on the decisions that all of us make every day, because, you know, we're here today. It's our world. We're living in it. We make things happen or not happen. But I don't believe that anything is determined. And I'll give you two examples of that. Britain, by 1979, was significantly more socialist than the United States is today. It was an absolute mess. The economy was a disaster area. That Britain was the sick man of Europe was what was the line that everyone was, you know, quoting. One third of everybody in Britain lived in government-owned housing. One third of the entire population lived in housing owned by the government. Virtually all the major industries, the British Steel, British Telecom, British Airways, virtually every major industry, British Coal, you know, if it had the word British in it, that meant it was run by the government. They were all socialized government entities. And the unions that represented the workers basically, you know, just had a stranglehold on the entire country. And Thatcher came in, and she didn't just reverse that. She showed people how much better a life they could have without this. Because I do not believe that the people on welfare, you know, in the housing projects, you know, have a great life because of what the government's given them. and she showed them what was better and completely changed politics in Britain. What was fascinating, and this is like you could do a political science term paper just on this, or a PhD dissertation, is how Margaret Thatcher changed the Labour Party. That is, not her party, the other party. The Labour Party, when Margaret Thatcher took office as a conservative, had specifically endorsed, complete socialism. The government ought to run the entire economy. That was their official platform. Did you know that after a few years of Thatcher, they were forced to change it? Because people realized how much better they had it under Thatcher's small government free market policies, she forced the Labour Party, the opposition party, to the right. They when she privatized the government-owned housing, she allowed people to buy the housing that they lived in that was owned by the government, and said, you can now buy it, it's yours, and you can sell it, and let your kids marry, whatever you want. And initially, the Labour Party was hugely against it. They were screaming that this was how outrageous this was. After a couple years, they changed the Labour Party platform retroactively to agree that that was the right thing to do. Okay? So you can change this. What's missing in our country today is the political will, but that's on us. And if you want even better, I'll give you an even more extreme example than that. Let's look at China. Now, the government of China today, as a government, stinks. They're totally repressive. There's no free speech. All the kinds of freedoms that we would want are not there. But the China in the 1970s was one of the poorest countries in the world per capita. They, I believe, had a per capita income of something like $50 per person, a year. That's what you lived on for a year, with a dollar a week in the 1970s in China. And what they decided to do in the 80s was to embrace capitalism, not political freedom, which is unfortunate, but they did embrace capitalism, and now their economy is actually officially now bigger than the United States economy. Their economy has been booming for a couple decades now because they decided to embrace capitalism. And I think we can all agree that China, under Mao Zedong, and we may not like Obama, but I think we agree that China, Mao Zedong's China, was even farther in a government controlled direction than the United States is. And so those are two examples in our lifetime where countries have gone farther left than we have and come back and discovered the kind of prosperity for everybody that capitalism causes. So no, it is never too late. It's never over. And whatever happens, the sun will rise the next morning, and we got a world to and decide where we want to move it.
Yeah, so there. And you know what, that's a we should point out, in all of these books, they're not just it's not just making fun of whatever the, whether it's, the New Democrat or the Gorax or the Wizard of Iz. It's not just to pull out all the stuff that's truly absurd and make fun of it. Every single one of those books has actually a really upbeat ending and shows possibilities for how that can be fixed.
Absolutely. I try to, I've got something of a formula here that I'm trying to, play out differently, but to stick with the formula. And one of them is that I always try to be upbeat at the end, and I always reflect it back to the reader at the end. If you notice, all of my last lines of all three books, go back to the reader and say, you ready to do something about this? In effect, although, in different ways. And if you want, I can tell you real quick, I think we've got just the last page or two that we haven't covered in terms of the narrative.
Yeah, go for it.
The third character to get his questions answered, and you had asked me about this, is the Cowardly Rhino. And he is told that you're making this mistake, that what people want is moderation. And this is obviously something I feel very strongly about. I think it is the dumbest, most incorrect political idea in America today, that the Republicans do better by being moderate and appealing to the middle. And it is an absolute lie. It's worth noting that the Democrats believe no such thing. When the Democrats lose an election, do they look for somebody more moderate next time? You gotta be kidding me. They look for somebody, you know, even when I don't even think it's possible for them to find anyone farther to the left. They do. They find someone farther to the left than the person they lost with last time.
And she wears a Mao outfit.
that's right. And so anyhow, so the cowardly rhino is taught that, people are not looking for a moderate. People are looking for a solution. They're looking for someone who has core beliefs and principles that can lead us to a better future, and that you're abdicating your entire responsibility here by allowing the Democrats to paint you into this corner where you're like, oh, I'll just split the difference, we'll be halfway. Nobody wants that. That excites nobody. Whereas if you can paint him as Reagan did, as Thatcher did, as Coolidge did, these were some of the most electorally successful conservatives in the entire history of the Western world. Those three people right there, what they all did is they clearly, unambiguously had a message of maximum freedom and minimal government, and then they demonstrated how well it worked, and people loved it. So that is what the rhino is taught. At the end, he throws away his white flag and picks up an American flag instead. I love the symbolism. And the hardest issue I had to deal with, and I had written most of this book before I figured out, to be honest, what I was going to do with Dorothy. I was trying to think about how to get her back home again. You know, I had this image of balloons, taking her back home to the world that she came from. And I finally realized that was all a mistake, and that it was time, for another plot twist. And that what the correct answer, and this is what Hillary is told, Dorothy is told, is that she can't go back. That nobody can go back. Going back in time is not an option. And I think this was the message I realized that I wanted to give. Because people say, I wish I could go back to the era of Ronald Reagan. Well, you can't. Okay? So face up to that. You can't do that. What you can do is change the world that we're in today. And that's what Dorothy learns, is that the one option that is open to you is you can make the world of today better. And that one of the lines is that if you can change history, and the history books will talk about you the same as the heroes that you look up to, from previous times. And the wizard, realizes he's late for his 8 o'clock date, and the four heroes are left to decide how they're going to change the direction that the country is going into. And I think the last line of the book is, "How about you?"
It always returns to the reader. And what are you going to do? So now that you've enjoyed all this fun, the kind of, I guess in a nice way, sort of pokes them in the chest a little bit. And it's like, you are part of the solution. And we require, it's required that you become part of it.
That's right. The future is in our hands. There's a time before we're born and a time after we die when we don't have any impact at all. But, here we are, and we can. And it's not a job for one person. This is something that we're all involved in. Obviously, I try to do my thing in the books that I'm writing, and I like to think that this is having a positive effect on the debate. And, you guys have a great radio show where you're doing it. And this is not, it's a huge mistake to say this is a job for those people or these people or that guy. It's a job for every one of us. There's a million things that need to be done if we're going to change the direction of the country. And every one of us has a piece of it.
Exactly. And sitting around, the book is interesting. It's a great play on real life. Sitting around making fun of it is fine, but at the end of the day, you have a responsibility. And I think that's the part that a lot of people have not quite come to grips with, is because they feel like, well, I'm not in elected office, or, my vote doesn't count. There's so much voter fraud. It doesn't matter.
Well, and
nobody's conservative enough, blah, blah, blah.
That's the effect of what's happened in our government. I mean, it's caused people to lose heart, and it's caused people to just realize, you know what, I don't need a job. I'll just you know, go on government assistance, and, you know, if something comes my way, I'll take it. If I make more than I'm making on... I mean, I've had people turn jobs down because the government assistance is more than what I'm willing to pay them to work. And I mean, that's a sad state of affairs. We've got to change that around. You're absolutely right. I think everybody has a role to play in that. And that, I guess that's what I like about your books, is it really exposes the lunacy of so many of these policies and actions by these people that are currently, you know, in power. They're playing everybody.
Well, and the mainstream media, of course, just fans the flames. It's kind of like, you know, it's hopeless. You can't do anything about it,
right?
Anyway. And so you might as well just stay home.
Yeah.
And, of course, if people do that, that creates its own...
More of the
that
same.
Creates its own train
more
wreck.
More the same.
Bob, do we have another break we have to take? We do, don't we? I knew I was behind on something. There was something nagging at me. All right, one more quick break. We'll come back and finish up the hour with Lauren Spivak, author of The Wizard of Iz and a couple other great books. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and you can get all the information there. Nice, Bob. Little Hillary theme song there. We got a lot of good Bill and Hillary songs on here. Oh, my gosh.
This may be the best job of all, is picking your bump tunes.
Oh, my gosh. Well, see, that's why we have to have our show on Sunday, because that's when Bob's the engineer. So we realized we had a combination that worked, and we didn't want to screw up the mix.
It is a great job.
It is pretty awesome. Hey, and Bob had a question during the break, but I told him just ask it himself.
Well, I was just curious. We didn't get too much into it in the previous hour, but some of the plot lines that actually involve Hillary herself, we haven't learned too much about that yet in the Wizard of Iz.
Well, Hillary does not play that big a role in the plot. It's you know, she's like the witch in the Wizard of Oz. You know, she's there, she's a central figure, and there's a fair amount of humor that's on, you know, on those, you know, couple of pages. I'm very deliberately trying to put this in a bigger context, because I don't think, and I think it's a mistake to think that, you know, Hillary is not, you know, a good person and not someone I want to see as president. But to say that she is the problem really is overselling her. She is representative of the problem. Okay, she isn't the problem, and the problem is this larger, you know, governing consensus that we need to address. And it actually somewhat annoys me when I hear all the Republican candidates spend all their time, you know, going after Hillary. It was just fine, you know, in the long run they're going to have to do that. But I would really like to see them developing an alternative vision for American governance.
I think that makes sense, because there wouldn't be a Hillary if there wasn't a supporting framework, I guess, to allow that to happen. And
exactly. So I've got, you know, when you do what I do, which is, you know, books that, you know, the original Wizard of Oz book, you know, has thousands of words, and, you know, mine's got a few hundred. You know, I've got to keep it very tight. that I don't want, you know, I don't have space to, you know, get into sidetracks, you know, very much. And I, and there's like key issues I want to touch. And what to me is the issue facing us in the 2016 election is how we're going to deal with the size and scope of government, how we're going to deal with education and taxation, and political corruption and the news media. And, you know, and Hillary is in the center of it all, but she is not the sum total of it. So, and as you point out, and I think you have probably, there's three or four, you know, pages or five pages where Hillary actually appears. You have probably the middle of those in your book where, you know, it deals with, you know, her, the donations to the Clinton, the laundry chute, yeah, where the donations to the Clinton Foundation are pouring in, to her room, and there's her email server, and, you know, and her dungeon and all of these other things.
Yeah, but I like that her dungeon is filled with her books.
Well, so there's a running joke that her books are just a drug on the market. They're piled up everywhere in the story because, you know, she got like a multi-million dollar advance, and I think they sold about 14 books.
It's true. There's just a zillion of them. It's hilarious. At first, yeah, I was like, what does that say?
No, they're in Costco now.
And I started looking at the box title. Oh, hard choices. Okay.
Yeah. They're heading off to buck a book at a record pace, at a record speed.
Buck a book.
And she says... She says, who cares if they're terrorists who hate Christians and Jews when I can just blame a video that got 26 views?
any other thoughts for us here in the last, like, you know, minute and a half?
Well, it's, you know, I look at this, and it's a cliche to say that, you know, this is a turning point in history, but, you know, everything's a turning point in history, and it is. And I guess what I want people to focus on is, you know, what the real issues and the real choices are facing our country going forward, and the importance of people who care, you know, getting involved. And I try to bring that into all of the books, and try to explore, you know, different corners of our society. One of the things I talk about in my third seminar is, which gets into history a lot, and we talk about, you know, what the real lesson of history. And I believe that the real lesson of all history is that every generation has its own version of insanity. It does something that's just insane, and future generations will always look back and say, my gosh, they were insane. How could they have believed that? You know, that's how we feel when we look back at the Salem witch trials,
yeah,
or, you know, medieval doctors bleeding people to death. You know, we look back at these periods of history, my God, how could anyone have believed that?
And
so the trick is to understand the insanity in our own time. That is easy to pick out some previous generation's insanity, but if you understand the insanity in our own time, and that's what I'm trying to touch on, you know, the left-wing news media, the crazy idea that government spending is good for the economy, environmentalism are all examples of our own craziness, and that's what we need to deal with.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you very much for coming on.
You have done such a good job with it. Mr. Lawrence Bevec.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks again. So join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. All the information is there about our guest, Lawrence Bevec. Next week, we will be all about Normandy. You guys are going to love it.
And you're listening to KCNR, Shasta.